This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In Cassandra King's house, there's a whole lot of writing going on. She is a best-selling author of five novels, a woman who has been called the queen of Southern storytelling, whose latest novel, Moonrise, takes place in Highlands, North Carolina. King's husband is Pat Conroy, also a best-selling author whose books Prince of Tides and The Great Santini became major motion pictures. While Conroy's novels are heavily influenced by what he calls his military brat upbringing, King's seem heavily influenced by her life experiences growing up in L.A., Lower Alabama, and her experiences in adult life, fitting into new families and situations, all while helping readers see themselves in her characters' struggles with the same issues and dilemmas they face in their own lives. King's latest novel, Moonrise, is a perfect example of putting a mirror up to modern life, drawing on her own background and, at the same time, paying homage to a previous work that influenced her own life and the lives of many other readers. Cassandra King joins us for the hour. Welcome to Charlotte. Hello.
It's
and
great.
Welcome to WFAE.
It's great to be here, Mike. Thank you.
I sound much worse than I feel, so do not feel sorry for me. Your latest novel, Moonrise, was inspired by Daphne du Maurier's Rebecca, classic gothic novel. Why did you feel you wanted to pay homage to this book?
It came about in a serendipitous kind of way. I did not sit down and say, I think I want to write, you know, or pattern a story after Rebecca. I was already thinking in terms of a story. I planned to set it in the mountains. The atmosphere of the mountains seemed to work with having an old estate and having a new wife come into this situation where she felt alienated and in the shadow of the previous wife, and this is her summer home and gardens and so forth. Coincidentally, or maybe not, that summer I started rereading a book that I had loved as a teenager, Rebecca. And when, as soon as it just hit me, and that was sort of serendipitous too, you know, this epiphany of, whoa, this is the book this is the story. It's very much like the story I want to tell.
Do you think that story had been in your mind since you were, I guess you read it first when you were 14 or something like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it very well could have, because it's a masterpiece of gothic suspense in every way. You know, the prototype, I guess, for gothic suspense, because there's so much the reader's not allowed to see, and you're drawn into this world with the narrator. The narrator never has a name. She's just the, you know,
that's
the
in
wife.
In Rebecca.
Yeah, in Rebecca, yeah. It's, when, of course, I read it for the story and, you know, just for fun and so forth when I was younger. But as a writer now, I look back on the craft and how she did this. How de Maurier pulled this off to have you not know anything about this woman until everything comes out in the end.
And de Maurier's story, Rebecca, is said to be, I read yesterday, a reworking of Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre. So are there elements of Jane Eyre in your book as well, you think?
Because it's a similar, I see why I've never heard that before, but that's an interesting thought, because it's a similar thing of the master of the house, and a woman comes in, a young woman who is out of her element.
Right.
You know, she comes from a different background. She's trying to find her way. She's trying to find herself, and she finds herself in a very gothic kind of, you know, mysterious, maybe even haunted place, weird noises at night and suggestion of ghostly, you know, spirits and so forth. So, yeah, I can see.
There was a real fascination with the afterlife and the seances and things like that from the late 1800s into the early 1900s, in which I think Rebecca probably fits in because it was 1938.
Exactly.
But evidently that same interest in dark shadow, kind of, I don't mean the television show, yeah, but dark shadows in the moonlight and the spirit world and perhaps being seeing things or hearing things that aren't there. There seems to be still a great interest in that in the 21st century. Why do you suppose that is?
I think because there's always been just a universal thing. I've always been I have been to seances. I've been to a white witch's cleansing ceremony in Highlands.
Really?
Yes, indeed. But she was from the from Florida. Oh goodness, I knew I'd go blank on it. It's a well-known place among people that are into the spirit world, okay, kind of thing. Casadella, I think. Casadella, Florida.
In the seance that you went to, did a spirit present itself in the seance?
Oh, of course.
Legitimately, you think, or was it staged?
Well, I think legitimately because, see, I'm really into all that kind of stuff. Okay. And my grandfather's house was still is, as far as I know, notoriously haunted down in South Alabama. And
is there a reason for the haunting?
Well, my great-grandfather died in the house, and he walked with a cane in his later years, and we used to hear him walking up and down the stairs.
Right.
And sometimes he played the piano, would hear the piano playing at night, and my mother said, oh, the cat ran across the keys. Are you girls, you know, you're just being silly. You didn't hear thumping noises on the steps. But we did, you know. So I became interested in the spirit world at an early age.
So I hate to get off on a tangent here, but I've never met anybody who's been to a seance. So the seance that you went to, you went because you have an interest in that.
Yes.
You didn't just go for entertainment value or for curiosity. You actually went.
Well, for curiosity, yeah, but not just for it. No, I've had an interest in this. It's Mike, I guess when I started talking about it, I realized I'm sort of surprised that I haven't written something along this line before. But this, of course, in Moonrise is just the suggestion,
right,
as it is in Rebecca.
And it's not a retelling of Rebecca.
It is not.
It is a tip of the hat to Rebecca.
Yes.
Is it difficult to do that? I mean, when you sat down to write it, were you thinking Rebecca in your mind all the time, or did you have, as you got into it, did you just think, well, I've got this story to tell, it's my story, and here I'm going to tell it? Or were you actually thinking, okay, how do I tip my hat to Rebecca without telling the story again?
Right, yeah. No, I did at one point even consider a retelling because I thought to myself, I don't think I've ever heard of a retelling of Rebecca. But I was already into it, and I have, you know, of course, my own style, and I usually have these zany Southern characters in it, and I certainly do in this one as well. I wanted to do something have a character that was one of the local mountain people. And so it didn't quite, you know, it wouldn't have quite worked, but then once I got into my own story, I really kind of went out of my mind. So no, I never actually said, okay, let me see if I can work this in, because that would be similar to something that happened in Rebecca. Though I did maybe subconsciously do that, because I do have a scene at a birthday party. It's kind of a big moment in the book. And my main character, the new wife, is set up to make a fool out of herself, much as the nameless narrator,
right,
was set up by the evil Mrs. Danvers.
The Du Maurier's book, which is 1938, can be melodramatic. I think you've avoided melodrama in Moonrise, but you have given it a gothic feel. What are the elements you need to give it that feel?
you've got to have you've got to have the tension. You have to have an element of suspense and the unknown. What is really going on here? Is there a supernatural element? I think it helps to have the setting to be also mysterious and remote and forbidding, and there's a sense of foreboding about it as well.
And the setting here is the house called Moonrise, which is a Victorian house at the top of a mountain. Mm-hmm. But in spite of the fact that it's probably bathed in sunshine at the top of the mountain, it appears out of a tunnel of, as you approach the house, a tunnel of what?
Rhododendron.
Rhododendron.
Yes.
And at night is very creepy because it's Victorian. Of course it's creepy. We're talking to Cassandra King this morning, novelist, and her latest book is called Moonrise on Charlotte Talks here on WFAE. In a nutshell, Moonrise is about this woman who has married she's married a guy she works with at a television station.
That's right.
In Florida. Mm-hmm. And she begs him, once he finds a little bit about the summer home that he has in Highlands, she begs him to take her there for the summer. And that's where she runs into trouble because she meets all of his circle of friends there, the summer people who come there for the summer, who were friends of him and his late wife, who has died under suspicious circumstances. And at first the friends are upset with him for having married so soon after the death of his first wife. And then when they meet her, they're upset with her because she doesn't measure up.
She doesn't measure up. She's nothing like the previous wife, very much as the situation in Rebecca. She's a younger woman. And I think most of us women, well, I can't even call myself middle-aged anymore, but, you know.
What?
Yes. She's 15 years younger than Emmett. He's a very well-known. He had been an anchor man at CNN and made quite a name for himself. And so they begin to suspect that this young woman who frankly, they look down on. They think she's a floozy. You know? That maybe she set her cap for him. He came down to run this news station, just to get away from Atlanta and CNN after his wife's death.
Right.
A few months after, he was so devastated by her death that this was a way of just getting away for a while. But when he goes there, down to South Florida, he meets this young woman and falls in love, and they marry rather hastily. Her friends, Rosalind, the former wife, her friends do not welcome this news and this new wife.
When you say she's a floozy, she's not really a floozy,
no,
but she does not have the, I guess maybe the class, the elan that the first wife had, because the first wife came from money.
Yeah, she's a socialite, an Atlanta socialite from old Atlanta money, and it's like old Charlotte money, I'm sure. Mm. You know these people. And Helen came from a different background altogether.
And she wears tropical colors, but she doesn't know what's the Pulitzer. What's Pulitzer?
Lily.
Lily Pulitzer. She doesn't know where. She doesn't realize that she could wear a nice, tasteful tropical clothes that Lily Pulitzer would design. All right, we have to take a break. Cassandra King is our guest. She's the author of Moonrise and several other books. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Cassandra King is with us, New York Times bestselling author of books like Making Waves in Zion, The Sunday Wife, The Same Sweet Girls, Queen of Broken Hearts, and her latest, which is called Moonrise, which is set in a Victorian house, or actually the whole book is set in Highlands in North Carolina, which is where you and your husband, Pat Conroy, occasionally have rented a house in Highlands, very much like, evidently, this house that your characters are staying in, what you describe as a dark old house in Highlands. Now, I have to ask, why two people such as yourselves, who could rent a house almost anywhere, would choose to rent a dark old house in Highlands.
Well, writers, you know, we're weird anyway. We're always doing the unexpected. But one of the things that we have to do when we're working, and I was working this summer, we rented this house, is have some isolation. And we certainly got it with this. Mm-hmm. It's isolated. There are no neighbors around the house. It wasn't on the rental market. We just got it through a friend of a friend, that kind of thing. And it had these wonderful gardens around it. And, of course, I was enchanted with it when it was brought up that this might be a place that we might consider for the summer. The drawback was really that it was dark and gloomy and larger than we needed and hidden away, and I would be staying there by myself quite a bit. Mm. So I began, of course, to get kind of spooked in there.
Because this house in the novel, the house is called Moonrise in the novel, so it takes the title of the novel. Novel's title. Title takes the title of the house, the name of the house.
Yes.
Peace. This house has moon gardens, which have fallen into disrepair. And it's also a place where you describe Highlands, the place you vacation, as a place where close bonds are forged and remain for generations. And that is what she, your hero, Helen, is facing when she goes to Moonrise, this circle of friends that have known each other forever, and it's almost impossible to become one.
Yeah, I think that was when I decided that I really wanted to write a book set in this Highlands Cashers area. I was thinking how rich it would be in story because of the influx of so many people. People who've had homes up there for generations, who have formed these close bonds, and then bring folks, well, like Pat and I, coming into a group of some friends he had known from Atlanta, but we were taken in, you know, to the group of friends then in Highlands. And that's pretty much, we have Florida friends, we have some Georgia friends, and you know they're their own little groups, and I think they've been together a long time and close friends. So losing one of them, as I have this group in Moonrise do, it's a blow to the whole group and to the bond that they've had for years or generations.
Writers have to write somewhat about what they know. If you don't know what a place is, it's not going to ring true.
Yes.
So some of this stuff at Highlands and the house comes from that. And I know that you have – comes from your life. And I know that you had one book that you wrote, and I forgot which it was, that you had to be very careful about disguising the people in the book.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
Because they would be – they were your friends, and you wanted them to remain your friends. So are people in this book based on people that you know?
Yes, and I should have been more careful like I was in The Same Sweet Girls. I've already had friends in Highlands who say they're afraid to read the book. And then another friend of mine says everybody in Cashers and Highlands is talking about this book because they're trying to figure out who is who. And I told her they don't have to try too hard. I even used some of the names.
Really?
Yes, I did. I have a chapter where there is a poetry reading at the Bascom.
Right.
And the
Bascom exists. I was going to ask you about that.
Yes, I used some real places, you know, in Highlands. I did take some poetic license with some of the places, but I have a group of women who are just gossiping away, and I use some of my friends' names there. So
in the crowd, not the lead.
In the crowd, no, not my lead.
You're from Lower Alabama, and you live now in Beaufort, South Carolina, at least part of the year, if you're not in the Highlands. Is there something about the South that lends itself to this kind of storytelling? And could this have been written by a northern or a midwestern or a Pacific Northwestern author and set in one of those locations as effectively?
Well, I think all writing is regional writing in some ways, because if the setting is part of the story usually, mm-hmm. but there's always the universal elements of storytelling, too. But, I think the South lends itself more to Gothic settings. I mean, you couldn't set the story in New York City. You've got to have an isolated, place for an old Victorian estate. So it couldn't be in Destin, Florida. Setting is important here. But, and the South has this... I think we have a very Gothic setting, and most southern, even like Beaufort, South Carolina, has these wonderful big old trees that are hung with Spanish moss, and a lot of places are hidden away, and the mountains, really, with the remoteness and the isolation, I think you really get that Gothic feel.
And you put this in a real town in the mountains. Mm-hmm. You didn't have to. Why did you make the decision to set it in a place that actually exists and mention some of the landmarks and some of the topography that actually exists in that town? Why was that important?
That's a really interesting question, Mike, because what I have used in some of my other books, I set out for, they're all in real places in my mind. For example, my second novel, the Sunday Wife, I was going to use Dufuniac Springs, Florida. It's just a little town that's so enchanting to me, and so forth. I just wanted to use it as one of the places there that the preacher and his wife go to. But it did not work in the plot, so I had to fictionalize the town. However, my last book, I used a real town, Fairhope, Alabama, because the town worked, and it's the same with Highlands. I just wanted to use some of the old Edwards Inn is in the wine garden. I just wanted to actually use a little town.
So, should people be careful around novelists, because is everything in life fodder for the next book?
Absolutely. we need to carry a sign around that says, watch out or you might find yourself in my next book.
What about character names? Because to me that would be very difficult to come up with names for people. Helen Honeycutt is the lead character. She's the new bride that's referred to by everybody as the new bride in the book. And then you have this former CNN star, Emmett Justice. Is that Wolf Blitzer? Who is that?
I'll never tell.
Actually, is it based on somebody? John King.
All of my characters, I think, are composites of folks either that I know or wish I knew or something like that. But I did interview someone who used to work at CNN, who will have to remain nameless because that was a condition. names are my favorite thing about characters, picking out a name for them. And once I get the name, then I know the character.
Well, let's talk about some of these names.
Yeah.
Dr. Link Varner and his wife, his Yankee wife,
Mina.
Who is the Pulitzer Prize-winning poet.
Yes.
Whose work is not well-liked by most of the circle of friends in this book. When you got Dr. Link Varner's name and Mina's name, what did that tell you about who these people were?
Well, Link is a little bit of an exception to this rule in that he's based on a friend who he was not a professor, but he was a counselor who died at early age. But he was the wisest man that I knew, and he was sort of my Zen master, a friend I had in Birmingham. Uh-huh. And so I knew I would use Link eventually, and some of his wonderful sayings and his calmness and the way I would go and talk with him, you know, about problems and so forth, because he was a counselor.
What about Mina?
I did try to think up a name that seemed, and the Mina Bird.
You know? I was just thinking about
it. Yes, because she's kind of a harpy,
yeah.
You know, and she's not a very likable character. And also, I've seen some of these people. We know someone who's won the Pulitzer, and the joke is, how long will you have to be around him before he finds a way to drop that into the conversation?
Noel Clements and Tansy Dunwoody, these are both socialites from Atlanta.
That's right.
And Kit Rutherford, a rich widow and the best friend of the first wife, Roslyn. What about their names and how it informed who they turned out to be?
Tansy just looked like a tansy. I think everyone knows.
I don't know what a tansy looks
okay.
like.
Okay. Well, yeah, it's actually a flower. But, yeah, and I think you only can find it in England. But to me, she fit her name. I guess it could have been Pansy or something like that, because she's one of these real sassy Southern women that say what she thinks. So she couldn't have been named Alice, I don't think,
right.
You know, or Mary. She had to have a sassy-sounding name. And Dunwoody, I mean, you know where I got that. She's an Atlanta socialite.
Right.
So, and Noel is the perfect man. And he's charming. He's good-looking. He's witty. He's wealthy. So he had to be named Noel.
Yeah. And then there's Willa McPhee, who's the property manager.
Yes.
And who cleans the house, and she's one of the people who lives in Highlands all year round. The circle of friends, though, contains people who are very different personalities. And you think, well, why would they want to be around that person, or why would that person even be in the group because of that? But that's how circles of friends really are.
Exactly. That was my thoughts too, Mike. I was thinking in terms of a colorful group of friends. You know, folks like Mina, who came into, but she came into the group like Helen and. And she was not really accepted, but she's not she's not a very likable character, so you can sort of understand why they didn't accept her, and she's fairly recent. Link had been a bachelor for all these years, and he meets this poet from New York, and they marry, but not very happily.
Yeah.
And he says later that you'll do strange things when you're lonely.
Tansy and Noel have an interesting relationship because they live in the off-season or in the non-high season in Atlanta, and they mm-hmm. live in the same condominium building but in different condominiums, and they
yes.
share a house when they come to Highlands. Exactly what is their relationship?
Well, that's a topic of much discussion, and that's also based on some folks I know that, you know, I think sometimes when men and women are friends, as Tansy and Noel, they're friends who live together part of the time. Yeah, are they lovers? Are they not? You know, they've been together for so long. They met each other as kids, both of them parents having, you know, homes in Highlands and this sort of stuff, that they're almost like brother and sister, but they're not that either. So they have one of these really strange relationships.
Cassandra King is our guest, and we're talking about her latest novel, Moonrise, this morning on Charlotte Talks here on WFAE. Do you know people like Tansy and Noel?
Oh, yes.
You do?
Oh, yes, indeed.
And that's not that's, how do I put this? No one ever talks about what you're all about, the two of you. They never ask questions about?
Not in a straightforward. You know, nobody in the South straightforward. Not going to come out and ask you know, if you're lovers, but just in very roundabout ways.
One of the reasons that you liked Rebecca, the novel that kind of began this adventure, this Moonrise mm-hmm. adventure, is the memorable characters that Du Maurier creates, and you've obviously created some yourself. How difficult is that? How do you go about creating characters that are believable and consistent in their behavior once you get them, give them these sets of characteristics?
I think you have to know these people as well as any of us can know anyone else. And one thing that helps me do this, Mike, is to write in different voices and in first person.
That can't be easy either.
It's not, believe me. It was easier in this book. I've told three of my five books in different voices. My first book, I used the voice of a young man, a young woman, and an 82-year-old woman.
Yeah.
So that was easy. I mean, I had three very distinct voices. And same sweet girls, I used women of the very same background, same age, and so forth. That was very difficult. Well, yeah. I almost gave up on that one.
Well, it seems to me that you've done it again. You tell the story in three different voices here. You have Helen's voice, Tansy's voice, and Willa's voice. You've got Helen, the protagonist. You've got Tansy, who's among the group of summer friends. And then you've got Willa, the housekeeper, and they all see the story from different points of view. The newcomer.
That's exactly what I was trying to do.
So but it seems to me that adds an incredible burden on you to tell this story. And each of these people do a different chapter alternatingly.
Yes.
Helen, Tansy, Willa, Helen, Tansy, Willa.
Mm-hmm.
How?
Well, I think, first of all, you have to decide whose story it is. And it's Helen's story. So I start out with Helen's voice and end with Helen's voice.
Right.
But in this particular book, I really wanted the different perspectives.
Tell you what, let's come back to this because we have to take a break. We'll come back to this on the other side and we'll talk about why you chose to do it this way and how difficult it must have been to do it this way and how you choose which part of the story you assign to a different narrator each time. We're coming right back with Cassandra King, Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is novelist Cassandra King, who is a New York Times bestselling author. Her latest book is called Moonrise. And she is going to be part tonight of the Women's National Book Association Charlotte's fourth annual Bibliofeast, which is it's a book and author dinner at Maggiano's Little Italy in South Park at 6 o'clock. You have to have tickets to get in, and I suggest you either go to the website for the Women's National Book Association or to Park Road Books, because they have tickets there, if there are tickets still available. I want to get back to the fact that you have an interesting device that you use to tell this story. You have three narrators, and they alternate chapters. You begin with Helen, and you end with Helen, who is the protagonist. Then you have Tansy. Helen's the outsider. Tansy is the insider in this group of friends. And Willa is the property manager who lives in Highlands year-round and sees these summer people in a different way from the way the summer people see themselves. How did you decide which parts of the story these individuals would tell and why?
What I like doing is having a scene and then having these different characters give their perspective on what happened. Because I think that's the way life is. If I used to do this when I taught, I would create an incident outside the classroom, and then the students didn't know I was doing this, an argument with a couple of other students, and then I would ask them to write about what happened. And we talked about, we would read them scenes of their descriptions of what happened, read them and talk about how everyone perceived things differently.
Because it's different. And
yes.
We really never see ourselves as others see us. So having these three different perspectives, it seems to me, is a really interesting device to get deeper into some of these characters and situations.
That's what it does. It helps broaden to me. It enriches to me a scene. I love reading, a book that's in different voices because of that. You see a scene or a character, and you begin to, as a reader, you begin to form your own opinion, and then you have Willa, especially in this book, serves as you said, someone who comes in that and has a entirely different look at these summer people,
right?
Because she's a mountain woman, she's one of the locals who work for these folks when they come in. And she talks about how they are all so nice to each other, but they stab each other in the back when they're, you know, well, don't turn your back on them and so forth. So she brings out some things that we wouldn't see otherwise.
Right. You've had four other novels before Moonrise, bestsellers and Book of the Month Club selections. Did that kind of success surprise you?
Oh, absolutely. I'm not one that can think about the readers, even though one of the things when I was teaching writing, I used to say is consider your audience, you know, so I'm not taking my own, you know, teacherly advice, but I don't think, I can only speak for myself, but I don't really see a writer sitting down and saying, oh, I'm going to write this book and everybody's going to love it and mm-hmm. it's going to sell well and this sort of stuff. Maybe so. You know, you just write, you have a story to tell and you do it and you hope that it speaks to people.
When your first book became a hit, does that put pressure on you for the next book?
Oh, absolutely.
Because I know I've talked to recording people, singers and, mm-hmm. and people like that, and they always say that it's more difficult to have your second hit song than it is to have
right.
your first. And Richard Carpenter, Karen Carpenter's partner in the Carpenters, mm-hmm. Deliberately released, I forgot which song they released first, probably Close to You, but I can't remember, but he kept the real hit back. He released the weaker song first so that when that's he thought it would be successful but not a major hit, so that when they came back for the second, he put out what he knew was the hit.
Wow, so that was a strategy.
Yeah, it was a strategy.
Absolutely, that's interesting. Yeah, you just put your books out there and you hope that they speak to readers, mm-hmm. and not everyone's going to, you know, I'm not bothered by bad reviews or whatever, because not everybody's going to
right.
to like what you've done.
But do you sit there while you're writing and think, that last one was a big seller? What can I do to duplicate that? I'm not sure this is going in the right direction if I want this to be a big seller.
No,
is it in the back of your mind?
I don't think you can do that.
Okay.
I think that would would freeze me as a writer. I don't think I could think. I just thinking I'm doing this now. I'm working on a story that I started years ago, a book, wanting to write about the family farm and saving the family farm, because I was raised on one and they're disappearing,
right.
you know, from certainly a southern landscape, and was already thinking in terms of what has become almost faddish now, sustainable, you know, farm to market
right.
food and,
right.
and this sort of stuff, and so. You know, now that I'm working on it, I don't know. I'm kind of thinking, well, is this going to seem like I'm jumping on the bandwagon? But I can't do that. I can't let myself think that way in terms of, you know, how is this going to be perceived?
You just have to do what you have to do and have the courage of your convictions to do
it.
You can't second guess yourself and think about what other people are thinking. You
no.
just do what it is that
no.
you do. This new book, Moonrise, is appearing 6 years, I understand, after the previous book, Queen of Broken Hearts. Why the long interval?
Well, I had a lot of other things going on in my personal life at that time. I had my sister, youngest sister, was very sick, and since some family member, you know, we joke about this, that if you're a writer, you don't really have a job, so you're the one that can go and do the, you know, things that they need, family members need something to do. But I was very close with my sister, and I took her to her treatments and this sort of stuff. So I just, had to put writing on back page for
a while. You were a writer and a writing teacher before you met Pat Conroy.
That's right.
But then you met him, and you married, and you live with him, and he's a writer, and you're a writer, and he's a very successful writer, and you're a very successful writer. Is there competition between the two of you?
So far, there's not been anything like that. Do
you help each other, or do you stay away from each other's work while it's in progress?
We stay away from each other's work and each other while we're working, I think. No, it's probably would be a good idea. But Pat, because I taught English and so forth, he'll ask me to read over and say, you know, check this out. You know, because he writes by hand.
Yeah, it's amazing to me.
It just pours out, though, and he'll have a lot of run-on sentences and this kind of stuff. So I do some editing like that, like a proofreader would do. You know.
Why does he write by hand?
I don't know. He can't.
Does that drive his editors?
He never learned to type.
Really?
Yeah.
Doesn't that slow him down, though?
Of course.
Maybe it makes maybe it gives him a chance to think about what he's writing, because he's slow. He has to be slow.
Well, that's right. But it does, when it comes, it just comes pouring out, and he just writes until his hands cramp up, I guess.
And you kind of got a late start, because I know you were an English teacher. You were teaching writing, and you went back to graduate school, I think it was 40, and got your degree, your master's degree, and your master's thesis became your first novel. You say it takes confidence and courage to be a writer, and you lacked both of those things.
I did.
What changed?
Oh, you know, I'm not really sure, Mike, that I know how at what point this changed, but had a lot to do with writing The Sunday Wife. Because that has a lot of autobiographical elements.
You were a Sunday wife. You were a preacher's wife.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep, I was. And so I had started writing and journaling and so forth, and I was thinking that I might write this, but I was trying to figure out how I could disguise it so no one would know it was me, because I didn't want folks to know about a failed marriage, and I'm a very private person. And
is it hard to be a private person when you've become a successful writer and you have to endure conversations like these around the country, and then your husband is also a very famous successful writer? Is it hard to be private?
It's almost impossible, yeah. And if you're going to write what you know, you know, the oldest advice in the world for writers, I think you have to write what you know, even if what you know is in your imagination, you know. It also takes courage. It takes a lot of courage.
You have said that you've told your husband, Pat Conroy, that he might consider writing fiction sometime, since so much of his material comes from his life and coming to terms with the great Santini, his father. You've also said that his writing has been like an exorcism, because he's getting it out of his system. And in fact, his new book is about nothing that came before. What is writing for you? If it's an exorcism for him, what is it for you?
It has become more like an exorcism for me as well, too. Because I went ahead and did The Sunday Wife, I had the courage and or confidence or whatever to go ahead with The Same Sweet Girls, which is a composite of a lot of stories of a group of women that I belong to that we met in college, and we've been calling ourselves The Same Sweet Girls ever since. And it's primarily writing for me is primarily not therapy or exorcism, but it's having a story to tell, bringing some truths to light, and some characters to life. For me, that's the way it works.
How do you write? How often do you write? What's your routine? Do you write every day, even if you have nothing to write, even if you're not working on a book? How does it work?
I don't know, because I haven't not been working on a book for a long time. But I've also written some essays. I had I want to write a cookbook. I've started taking notes on that.
These would be your recipes or recipes of friends?
No, they'll be my recipes. I like to make up my own recipes. And whenever I have a successful one, I grab my little notebook and write it down.
Well, the absence of Paula Deen has created a vacuum.
A vacuum. You know, I'm ready to step in. So.
Where do you write? Do you write in a little room? Do you write on a computer?
Yes.
Do you write in silence? Do you like distractions? What is it for you?
Okay, I do have a writing room. Fortunate enough to have my own little writing room, and I write on the computer. I write something most every day, because I said I do have these other little projects in mind. I'm also working on. I did a commencement speech at college in Georgia, and then in Alabama a few years later, and going to publish this as just a smaller book, kind of like life lessons, you know,
right.
Sort of book thing, and. So I'm working on some little project writing every day.
Cassandra King's new book is called Moonrise, here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I found a list of your 10 favorite books, because it seems to me if you're going to be a good writer, you have to be a good reader.
Yes,
you have to read
definitely.
Things. They include some really famous tomes like F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby, Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, Jane Eyre, which we already talked about, Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird, Charles Dickens' David Copperfield, all of books that I've read, but I'm not a writer. But then you also include books like Anne Morrow Lindbergh's Gift from the Sea, and Cross Creek by Marjorie Kennan Rawlings. Is there a running theme among these books?
I don't think so. I think I have a real eclectic reading taste. I will read. I read a lot of nonfiction. Sometimes a book like it's Gift from the Sea. I've forgotten now exactly how it's the title.
I think it's
Gift from the Sea.
Maybe I typed it wrong. I don't know.
Right. But A Movable Feast by Hemingway, you know, some nonfiction books that just something about the books appealed to me, and I want to read them again and again.
Huh. Moonrise has some interesting strong male characters in it. Is it easy for you or difficult for you to write in a male voice?
I love writing in a male voice. I really considered, I used Tansy. I wanted to use the perspective of one of the friends of Rosalind. And at one time I was thinking of using either Link or Noel. But Tansy's so bossy she wouldn't hear of it. So, you know, ended up using her. But, I love creating male characters because, you know, I'm a woman. I'm interested in men and what makes them tick and this sort of stuff. And I raised three sons.
Are we as inscrutable as you are?
Oh yes, very much so.
Both you and Pat Conroy are considered Southern writers. Do you consider yourself that? And very quickly, we have 15 seconds. What does that mean to you?
It means I'm a writer who writes about the South, and I do consider myself a Southern writer. You know, what else can I be? Mm-hmm. You know, I've lived in the South all my life. I'm Southern.
Cassandra King, New York Times bestselling author of Making Waves in Zion, The Sunday Wife, The Same Sweet Girls, Queen of Broken Hearts, and her latest novel, Moonrise, which takes place in Highlands, North Carolina. Thank you for the hour.
Thank you so much.